Good evening. I'd like to read from Psalm 45, please. Psalm 45. I suppose I ought to be deeply hurt, really, that the two other speakers have been invited to sing. I understand I have a very moving voice and estimate that I could probably empty the hall in 15 seconds if they'd invited me to do it, so you've been spared that. That's something to add to your many blessings that you count every night. Well, Psalm 45, please. And I'm in verse 8. Psalm 45, verse 8, please. All thy garments smell of myrrh and aloes and cassia. That's all I plan reading this evening from the Bible. Jews and Christians would agree that Psalm 45 is about the Messiah, what we label a messianic psalm. And that will explain, at least in part, why the writer to the Hebrews in chapter 1 lifts in verses 6 and 7 as one of his proof texts that Jesus is immeasurably superior to the angels. He's got 7 proof texts, no problem with verses 6 and 7 in Hebrews 1, because whether the readers were wearing their Christian hat or their Jewish hat, they would have said yes. That's about Messiah. Superior to the angels. In the verse before, it comes to us verses 8 and 9 in Hebrews 1. And just before he said, of the angels he saith, he makes his angels spirits or winds, ministers of flame of fire. But to the Son he saith, thy throne, O God, is forever. He doesn't make him anything. Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. Psalm 45 is a psalm of the king. The title, the king, occurs 7 times in the psalm, which is just coincidental. It is by title in the King James Bible, a song of loves. But when the Greeks translated the Old Testament, they translated it a song of the beloved. Very suggestive. Greek Old Testament. And the psalm unites the picture of a mighty warrior king in the first half, and he comes armed and equipped with weapons for near and distant combat. He's got a sword, verse 3. He's got arrows, verse 5. Mighty warrior king in the first half of the psalm. And then swinging on the hinge of what I've read to you tonight, the second half of the psalm is concerned with the wedding of the bridegroom. The bride, yes, she's there. Noted for her beauty and her glory. I'm interested just in the introduction to that section because the garments of the bridegroom are saturated by costly, expensive perfumes. I'm not interested in the perfumes. I want to consider this evening something of the fragrance of our Lord's garments. If I can put it that way, I want you to imagine a wardrobe. It is the king's wardrobe. And tonight we are privileged to open its doors, to probe, to peer into the king's wardrobe. And we find in the king's wardrobe 8 hangers. So let's just look at the hangers very quickly and we'll come back one at a time. On hanger number 1, there are swaddling clothes. On hanger number 2, there is, that which concerned one of our songs earlier, a garment with a very distinctive hem. On hanger number 3, there is shining white raiment. Hanger number 4, a towel, or perhaps a slave's apron. We'll come to that in due course. Hanger number 5 is a very full hanger, but these garments are inseparable. There is a seamless coat. There is a splendid robe, and there is a purple cloak, and they all hang positioned on number 5. Number 6 seems to have some linen cloths, and what might be a napkin of some kind or another. Hanger number 7. It's a long garment. It's a garment which reaches down to the foot, and is accompanied by a sash or girdle. Hanger number 5 puts me off a little. It's rather grim and gruesome. It's blood-stained vesture. So those are the 8 hangers, and they will tell us just a little about the glorious Lord that we worship. Hanger number 1, swaddling clothes, no prizes. Luke chapter 2, verse 7. You don't need to turn to it. She brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. Hanger number 1, swaddling clothes. Lord, what am I to learn from this hanger, please? He would say to me, Malcolm, you learn something of my grace, my condescension. Your grace, huh? You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, who, being rich, made himself poor because of you. This was part of the sign to the shepherds in the fields of Bethlehem. Unto you, born this day, city of David, Saviour, Christ the Lord, this shall be a sign to you. You shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. Babe wrapped in swaddling clothes? Yes. But who is this babe? Psalm 93 begins by speaking about the Lord as clothed with majesty and strength. Psalm 104 starts, he is clothed with honor and majesty. So you put the two psalms together, clothed with honor, majesty and strength, and behold him now, wrapped in swaddling clothes. Common, normal practice, strips of cloth bound tightly around the weak limbs of an infant, a babe, to prevent those limbs being distorted while they were weak. But who is this? What do we mean, weak limbs? This is none other than the one who has a mighty arm. I have in front of me a verse from Psalm 89. It reads like this. As for the world and the fullness thereof, thou hast founded them. Thou hast a mighty arm. Thank you, Ethan. Thou hast a mighty arm. Or what about Jeremiah 32? Poor man was in the court of the prison. Lord said to him, your cousin's on the way. His name's Hanameel. Got a business proposition for you. Wants you to buy a field at Anatot. Well, it all worked out that way. 17 shekels was the price. Suppose when everything was normal, that was a reasonable price for this particular field. Jeremiah paid up. Signed, sealed, delivered, deposited by Barak in an earthen vessel. Fine. Not fine. Thank you very much. Because at that very moment, parked on that field at Anatot was the mightiest war machine on earth. Nebuchadnezzar was out there with a lot of Babylonians. It was absolutely worthless, the poor parcel of land. Jeremiah just parted with 17 good shekels for this parcel of land. So he thinks, and then he prays. Wants to talk to God about this. Wants to tell him that it's in the hand of the Chaldeans, Lord. But before he gets there, he puts it all in context. Good man. Lord God, he says, thou hast made the heavens and the earth by thy great power and stretched out arm, and there is nothing too hard for thee. Well, that put Nebuchadnezzar in his context, really. You know, he's frank a little bit now. Though I have to say that by the time he finished praying, he started worrying again, and the Lord had to put his mind at rest at the end. It's a long story, forget it. What I'm interested in is his exclamation in prayer, "Thou hast a stretched out arm." Now, I would admit to you that although I found those texts which attribute to his great creatorial achievement, you know, those galaxies out at the extent of the universe, all attributed to the power of his arm, the Old Testament actually concentrates his mighty arm on the work of the Exodus 9 times. The deliverance from Egypt is attributed to his mighty arm, wrapped in swaddling clothes. But then that's the mystery of what we believe. That's the mystery of the incarnation. I said the writer of the Hebrews lists in verses 6 and 7. It's all there. Verse 6, "Thy throne, O God." That's all right. It's a statement of deity. Verse 7, "Thy God has anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows, above thy companions." Oh, so he has companions. He has people like me. And he stands on the one hand on level ground with God, and on the other hand he stands on level ground with us. But that's the mystery of what we believe. The Word becomes flesh. And God's only begotten becomes Mary's firstborn. In one sense, that bit I read from Luke chapter 2, it was her time. As Luke observes, while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. Her time had come. Oh, in another sense, it was God's time. In the fullness of the time, God sent forth his Son. The mystery of what we believe. Psalm 113 says this, "Who is like the Lord our God, who dwells on high, and who humbles himself to behold the things which are in heaven and on earth?" Whether it's those remote galaxies, or this little tiny planet. The God that you worship is so big that it is an act of condescension even to notice what he made. He humbles himself. What do you think the psalmist would have made of the statement that that God lay in human form in a manger with his limbs wrapped in swaddling clothes? That's hanger number one. I'm going to put a label on it. I'm going to say we're going to call this hanger his condescending grace. It's a lot to get on a label, but I just about do it. And I put it away. I move to hanger number two. It has a garment with a very distinctive hem. Still with Luke's gospel, I'll stay with Luke as long as possible. And we're in chapter 8, and I'm reading verse 44. It's about a woman with an issue or flow of blood. It says this, "She came behind him and touched the border of his garment, and immediately her issue of blood staunched." Oh, good. I know what to put on this label, Lord. I don't need to ask. I'm going to put the word power. Power, that's it. She was chronically ill. A hopeless medical case. When Mark describes her, and I do have to say that although it's the shortest of the Gospels, when Mark gets going with a story, he gives you more details than the others. He tells the stories the longest. He just tells less of them. This is how Mark described the poor woman. She had suffered many things from many physicians. She'd done the rounds. Having spent all she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. So that's how she's getting on with the doctors. Dr. Luke in his gospel confines himself to the statement, "She could not be healed by any." It's enough. I don't think there's any sort of professional defense there. That'll do. Hopeless medical case until the day she touched the border of his garment And then she encountered a power that was sufficient. Who touched me? Everybody denied it. Peter found this highly amusing. Didn't even give him his title, teacher or master or anything. He said, the crowd throngs, presses on you. And you say, who touched me? Jesus said, somebody has touched me. I perceive that power has gone out from me. Now Mark, when he's telling the gospel, tells us that when she touched the hem of his garment, she felt in her body that she was healed. And then Mark adds this comment, and Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out from him, she felt it, he felt it, felt the power go as she tapped his resources. It wasn't the first time. I'm in Luke chapter 8, I told you that. Back in chapter 6, I'm going to get to verse 19, but it's just the preamble to the sermon on the plain, as we call it. There's a great multitude there. Luke deliberately exaggerates it. You know, this great multitude came from all Judea and from the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon. That's excusable hyperbole. And then he says this, the whole multitude sought to touch him, because there went power out from him and healed them all. Now, that's fascinating. You've got a whole multitude. Everybody's trying to touch him, and as they touch him, they are healed. Today, in chapter 8, he's got a crowd all around him, jostling him, pressing on him, and nobody's getting anything except this woman, because they are not actually touching him in that sense. They haven't come for anything. They don't have the faith that we heard in the song. And so they received nothing, but she came with her faith, and she touched and she received. What did she touch? She touched the border of his garment. Once he'd been on the throne, and the border of his garment filled the heavenly temple, and there was not a seraph, not a burning one of the heavens, that would dare touch the robe of the king. They used two of their wings to keep flying, to keep hovering. They would not dare touch his robe. And here, in the flesh, this poor woman, wretched woman, came, and she touched the hem of his garment. Now the book of Numbers, it's in chapter 15, it's verse 38, talks about the border of the garment of the godly Israelite, and how he would put on the fringe of his border a riband or thread of blue. Now it had significance. God the Israelite does it so that every time he sees it, he will remember. Remember what? He will remember the commandments of the Lord. It's an aid memoir. Fine. And no significance for Jesus. He did not need a blue riband to bring to his memory the commandments of the Lord. They were written on his heart. And he had dictated them in the first place. And it was his finger. Twice he did it with his finger, which probably explains John chapter 8, but that's a long detour, so forget that one as well. Book of Numbers chapter 15 talks about this riband of bloom. Presumably it's that border she touched. If you go back into chapter 5 of Numbers, beginning of the chapter, God specified three categories of people who must always, invariably, be put out of the camp as unclean, as defiled. Doesn't matter, he said, whether they're men or women. That's irrelevant. Category number one, everyone that is a leper. Category number two, everyone that has an issue of blood. Category number three, everyone that contacts a dead body. It's interesting when Dr. Luke wrote up the casebook of the healing ministry of Jesus, he is careful to tell us he touched them all. In chapter 5, verses 12 to 14, it's the leper. Full of leprosy, says the doctor. Full of leprosy. Then he saw Jesus, and he fell on his face in obeisance and worship. If you will, you can make me clean. Jesus, this is what the gospel says, he put forth his hand, and he touched him, and he said, I will. Be clean. And immediately the leprosy left him, touched him. Well, we've read about the woman. He didn't touch her, she touched him. And intertwined with this story of the woman in Luke chapter 8 is that of Jairus' daughter. Luke wants you to take the two together. He gives you lots of clues about that. Not least that both of the daughter and the woman have something that happened 12 years ago. The girl was 12 years of age. This woman had contracted her disease 12 years ago, Luke says. Puts them in next verse to each other, so he wants you to think about this. And then you're thinking about this woman who's given everything that she had to get rid of something that she'd suffered and endured for 12 years. And there's this man standing there, and he would give everything he possessed, his office in the synagogue, you name it, he'd give it, just to hold on to something he'd enjoyed for 12 years. It was his little girl, and she was dying. And due to the delay, she died. But Jesus came, so everything's all right. Yeah, you can poke fun at him and say, sleeping, she's dead. He'd throw you out. And what would he do? He took her by the hand, and he said, child, rise up. Took her by the hand, and our Lord came into physical contact with the leper, issue of blood, and someone who was dead. Number 5 would say, defiled. God said, the Lord said, defiled, I dwell in the camp. You can't have people like that in the camp. But these people met a greater power. That's it, that's the word on the hanger. Because this garment with this hem speaks to me of his power to heal and cleanse. All right, move on to hanger number 3. Shining white raiment. No prizes. Still Luke, chapter 9, verse 29. I quote, as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered, his raiment was white and glistering. Luke makes it, I think, reasonably clear that the Mount of Transfiguration event took place at the dead of night. I know he doesn't say that, but there's enough circumstantial evidence. Went up the mountain to pray. While they were heavy with sleep, like most of my congregation. When they were thoroughly awake, which will happen when the call for food comes. And they came down from the mountain the next day. All right, hopefully you can accept my word for it. And he was there in our technical language, transfigured before 3 very privileged, though I have to say 3 very frightened disciples. Now naturally, when they were awake, what they noticed about him was his face and his clothes. I'm interested in his clothes particularly. Matthew dismisses it briefest. He says about his garments, white as the light. But that's enough. You actually won't improve on it. But that's all Matthew says. Mark, well, he's on one of his flights again. Tells us his garments were shining, gleaming, glistening, exceedingly, intensely white, as snow. These garments are so white they cannot be bettered by anything that nature offers, and they cannot be bettered by any amount of human industry and toil, so that no fuller, no launderer of earth could whiten them. Mark says all that. As I said, you know, when he gets going, he does it well. Luke says, they were dazzling white. King James Bible, they were white and glistering. They were ablaze with light. And this word glistering occurs 9 times in the New Testament, and on the other 8 occasions it is correctly translated lightning. That's what you've got in chapter 17. As the lightning shines from one part of the heaven to the other, so the Son of Man shall be in his day. Lightning. And what Luke is conveying to us is that those 3 favored men perceived in the garments of Jesus the very flash, the blinding flash of lightning. They're struggling. They're looking for vocabulary. Just to get over. And none of the 3 were there. They're only working on hearsay. And his faith, Well, Luke doesn't say very much. King James, the fashion of his countenance was altered. The appearance of his face changed. It was different. It's left to Matthew just to contribute the point. His face was like the sun. Now you've got two men, very important, men of great stature there. Moses and Elijah appeared with him in glory, but he overshadowed them, eclipsed them completely. His face was like the sun. So with this hanger, you have to be a little careful. You need your sunglasses or shades on when you take this hanger out. Shining white raiment. Label. Lord, please, what do I put on this label here, on this hanger? And the Lord would probably say, Malcolm, why don't you ask the one apostle who was there? All right. 2 Peter chapter 1, Simon Peter. We have not followed cunningly devised myths, he says. We were eyewitnesses. That word is technical, comes in from the Greek mystery religions. What Peter is saying is, we were initiated eyewitnesses. Of what? Of his majesty. His magnificence. The word? Thank you. I'll take that. That's on my hanger. Majesty. Shining white raiment. Next hanger. Well, we rather reluctantly part company with Dr. Luke, and we move into the fourth gospel, chapter 13. You're there before me, I'm sure. I'm in verse 4. He rises from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. In the context, John wants you to know that Jesus was thinking about, when he did what he did, was thinking about his own dignity and his own greatness. Jesus knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, that he came from God and went to God. Lord, what do you have in your hands? The Lord would say, well, in one sense, I have all things. The Father's given all things into my hands. In another sense, I have a towel. The word which occurs there in John 13, translated towel, doesn't occur anywhere else in the Greek Bible. It is, in fact, a Latin word. And one of the great Roman historians, Suetonius, described it as an apron worn by a slave. How he used the word. Now, I can't be quite sure, but I suspect that Simon Peter, in chapter 5 of his first epistle, has got his eye on the events of John chapter 13. He exhorts us, King James, to be clothed with humility. Literally, to gird on humility. There's lots of reminiscences in 1 Peter 5, and I suspect this is one of them. And that verb, to gird on, or to be clothed with, refers to something which is tied with a knot, and in particular, the white garment worn by slaves. So I think the circumstantial evidence, again, is sufficient to say that this towel may have actually been a slave's apron. But it doesn't matter what it was, it's what he's going to do with it. He girds himself and proceeds to what? To wash the feet of these men. Menial? Working in the kitchen? Menial? To wash the feet. The Jewish rabbis laid down that no Jewish slave would ever be required to wash the feet of a Jewish master. Now, if you happened to have a Gentile master, it was tough. You had to wash his feet. If you were a Gentile slave, you got a Jewish master, it's tough. You've got to wash his feet. But if you're a Jewish slave, you never had to stoop to wash the feet of a Jewish master. I had occasion in another meeting to refer to one Abigail, 1 Samuel 25, you remember the story of Nabal the fool, heart attack 10 days later he passed away. David was very impressed by the young lady that had come and applied a cool hand to a hot head. And, well, she had a lot going for her. Very intelligent, very spiritual, and very attractive. So David decided to cash in on this and sent his servants to make a proposal of marriage to her on his behalf. The response was interesting. Let your handmaid be a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. What she was saying was, yes, thank you, that would be a very nice idea. But it's a long way to say it. But she was using an expression, to wash the feet of, to convey her feeling of total unworthiness. It's the lowest, basest, most menial task, almost proverbial. What's the Baptist mean? I am not worthy to stoop down and undo the straps of his sandal. What do I undo someone's sandal straps for? Well, to take off his sandal. What do you take his sandals off for? To wash his feet. And the Baptist is saying, I'm not worthy of the least and lowest task. This isn't Abigail. This isn't John the Baptist. This is their Lord and Master, who girds himself with a towel or slave's apron and proceeds to wash their feet. And when a little later Iscariot went out into the night to collect a band of men to come and arrest him, his feet were ever so clean. The Son of God had just washed them for him. What a miserable man. I want a word. Give me a word. I think lowliness will do. Lowliness. All right. Slave's apron back on hanger. Oh, this one's heavy. What's this got on it? Well, it's got three things. It's got a seamless coat. It's got a splendid robe. And it's got a purple cloak. It's the story. Seamless coat, well, for him to be stripped of his garments, including the seamless coat, was just part of the shame of being crucified. Old Testament, New Testament combine to link the two ideas. Psalm 22, the prophet David. Sorry, some of you may get it, some may not. But anyway, Psalm 22, the prophet David. They pierced my hands and my feet. I may tell all my bones. They looked, they stared upon me. They part my garments among them and cast lots on my vesture. They pierce my hands and my feet. They part their garments. When you come to the evangelist, they take that point up. I'll quote the second gospel. It wouldn't matter which you went to. When they had crucified him, they parted his garments, casting lots what every man should have. There are four other bits. Each of the four executioners got a part. They're stuck with a seamless coat. So they cast lots again to decide who's going to get the bonus. The point was that he had died, not a natural death, he had died as a condemned criminal. And as such, he forfeit all rights, including the rights to his garments. They did not become the property of Mary. They did not become the property of his unbelieving brothers. They became the property of his executioners. It was part of the stigma, part of the shame of being smashed against a tree by the Roman state. A gorgeous, splendid robe. Where did that come from? Oh, well, it's all to do with this trial thing before Pilate. Chief priests and the people said, that stirs up the people! Beginning from Galilee, right to here! Galilee. You Galilean? When Pilate learned that he was of the jurisdiction, the authority of Herod. Oh, Herod Antipas! He's up for the feast. Excellent. And this gives him the opportunity to pass the buck. So he's referred to Herod. This is what happened. He was presented before Herod. Herod was delighted to see him. Been longing to see him for a long time. Wanted to see some entertainment. Some sign. King James Bible miracle. Some sign done by him. So he questioned him, it says, with many words. And what happened? Nothing. He stood silent before Herod. Say something! Silence. Jesus had nothing to say to the man who had silenced the voice that cried in the wilderness. Silent. Herod's patience snapped. Herod Antipas was not a king. His dad had been a king, Herod the Great. The king. Herod Antipas hadn't made it. He'd only got to an ethnarch. And I can imagine him sneering at Jesus. A king? Because that's the charge, of course. A king? If you were a king, you made more than I ever did. Let me tell you what the Bible actually said. Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught. They treated him with contempt, the word is. They mocked him. They arrayed him in a gorgeous, splendid, elegant robe, presumably out of Herod's own sumptuous wardrobe. And they sent him again to Pilate. He was back with Pilate, of course. Eventually, Pilate capitulated, handed him over to his own men, the soldiers of the governor, the Bible calls them. They thought this is great fun, so they called together the whole cohort. This is going to be worth watching. They clothed him with purple. And presumably, I guess, a discarded military cloak. They clothed him with purple. They plaited a crown of thorns. And they put it about his head. And then they proceeded to beat and pound it down with the reed scepter from his hand. A purple cloak. He was an object of contempt and derision. They mocked, they ridiculed his kingly claims. Lord, before I get to my label, why did you let them do it? Why did you endure that? And he would say, well, Malcolm, there are two answers. I did it for my Father. I'm in Psalm 69, if you're interested, verse 7. For thy sake, he says, for thy sake, I have borne reproach. Shame has covered my face. I did it for God, Malcolm. And I did it for you. Who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the Lord. You can't mean, can you, that the joy of having me with you and like you could compensate for all that shame and humiliation? I'll take the word, please. I'll put it on my hanger. Humiliation. And I move on. This is an interesting hanger. It's got some linen cloths on it. Well, we're moving on rapidly now. We're in John's Gospel. It's the last of them. And it's chapter 19. And I'm coming in at verse 38. Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. Pilate gave him leave or permission. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, no cassia. Myrrh and aloes, about 100-pound weight, that's 75-pound as we measure. They took the body of Jesus and wound it in linen cloths with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Lord, what do I learn from this hanger, please? What do I learn from these linen cloths? Well, he'd say, you know the sequel. You learn something of my victory in the realm of death. That's what you learn. It's an interesting first day. Everybody's running round. And Mary finds the stone's been moved. So off she goes, hot foot, to find Peter and John and tell them. Then they're at it. And they're racing back to the tomb to see. Well, John made it first. Presumably he's a little bit younger, though I can't prove that. But he got there first. He looked inside, but he didn't go inside. Waits for Peter. And as he tells the story in John chapter 20, he makes it clear they both saw the same thing. I quote his words. Saw the linen cloth lying. Uses that of himself, then he uses it of Peter. They saw the same thing. but only one of them grasped the significance. Only one of them understood that those cloths were lying in a most orderly fashion. No appearance of haste, no evidence of disturbance, and there was the napkin, separate to the cloths. John says he saw, and he believed. In all probability, but I can't prove it, he believed that the body had come through the grave clothes. I notice the way that John tells the story in chapter 11 when describing the raising of Lazarus. You remember that bit where he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" In chapter 5 he said that the hour is coming when those that are in the graves, the tombs, will hear the voice of the Son of God and they shall come out. Good job, he said, Lazarus. And they'll all be out. It's a much more prophetic program, I tell you, but Lazarus, come out. And this is how John describes it. He that was dead came out, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, his face bound about with a napkin. Jesus said, "Loose him! Let him go! You can't let him walk around like that, he'll frighten people to their death." You see, he came back, but his body's the same as it was before. It can't get out of the grave clothes. It's going to need help. Same kind of body. Went into the tomb through a door, came out the same door he went in. My Lord's body was taken in through a door. But he didn't come out through the door. The door was still shut when he came out. And I wonder if John is inviting us to think, this is something different. That's what struck me. The grave clothes. Nice smell in this tomb. In chapter 12, it was a house, and you've got Mary of Bethany and the spikenard and 12 ounces, or perhaps just between 11 and 12 ounces of the stuff, and the house was filled with the odour. But here, 75 pound weight of spices Nicodemus had brought. Or at least, I suspect he hadn't brought them. I suspect, being a man of influence and power, his servants brought them. I can't cope with 55 pound of potato. So, you know, 75 pound is a bit hard going for an old man like Nicodemus. But it doesn't matter. There were 75 pound of spices. And they would have been laid under the garment, under the body. They would have been packed around it. They would have been strewn in the linen bandages that were wound around his limbs. Why? Why is Nicodemus doing it? What's the point? What's the purpose of the spices? To preserve the body in death. That's a nice thought. Perhaps the Lord thanked him for the thought, but it wasn't needed. It wasn't possible for God's Holy One to see corruption. No need spices, but it was a nice thought. I'm sure the Lord appreciated it. Fear not, he says, in the beginning of our Book of the Revelation, fear not. I am the first and the last, the living one who became dead. Behold, I am alive forevermore. I look at those linen cloths and I say, yes, I will accept that. Victory in the realm of death. I can just about get it on the label. Number 7. Garment down to the foot. Book of the Revelation, chapter 1. Verse 12, John says, I turned to see the voice. You know what he means, I turned to see the voice. It's a strange way of talking. I turned to see the voice that spake with me. Being turned, I saw 7 golden lampstands. In the midst of the 7 lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, girt about the breast with a golden girdle. Lord, what's that tell me? And I guess he would say, it tells you something about my glory and my priesthood. John saw him in the midst of the churches, the glorified Lord. And his transcendent glory filled John with a tremendous sense of awe. He was He just felt totally overpowered by the one like the Son of Man. He fell at his feet as one dead. He just hit the deck when he saw him. Now, once he had leant on his breast, he had reclined on his breast of the... Don't recline on his breast now. Just like the four living creatures and 24 elders in chapter 5, they fall before the Lamb. So John goes down before him. Garment down to the foot. I suggest it has to do with his high priestly office. To the foot, or to the feet, translate